New York sense. They'd converted it into something quite different. And I was very intrigued, and so I went and introduced myself, and we chatted, and the festival duly happened, and someone lent me a guitar, and I ended up playing anyway, and I met all kinds of people, which led to all kinds of things. I met the residents there. I met the Muffins there. I met all kinds of people. And I figured out that New York is probably a place where I should go, and I hadn't got anything to do in London anymore because, and I always hated London because I'm not from London. So it seemed like a miraculous opportunity, and actually before very long I fell in love and got married and moved to New York all in kind of one big lump. So I ended up in New York a year later working with Zorn. And meanwhile, my friend Peter Blegvad was doing a gig on February 14th. And said, would I open for him? And I didn't have a band, but I said, okay. And I got together with Bill and Fred and said, would you like to do this gig? And we needed a name, and I thought, February 14th, well, there's some Valentine's Day Massacre, so we'll call ourselves Massacre. And that's how the band started. And I was trying to do the opposite of everything I had been doing. So instead of elaborate compositions that I've been doing in Henry Cow, everything was going to be short. Everything was going to be kind of semi-improvised. Fred was 16 at the time and had very little idea what we were doing, and we would not tell him. So we would sometimes, you know, arrange an elaborate cue to end a piece, and then we would basically give the cue, and he would stop, and we would just carry on. And he would have to deal with it.
Yeah, he just had no idea.
And that kind of led, in a way, to the character of the group, because we were constantly changing everything all the time, and the material became the bones of something completely different. And the piece you just heard was called Bones, and the piece before it was actually the same piece as years later done on Ground Zero, Otomo Yoshihide's record of standards. So by that time the Massacre, that first Massacre record, was considered to be standard to people who were involved in the noise scene. It was kind of a, I guess we were precursors of something. It's funny how quaint our version sounds after.
Yeah.
It's almost like surf music after listening to that.
Yeah, just the trio, yeah, with the whole big, noisy, big band version. Yeah, big band.
Right. I mean, in the meantime, a Massacre stopped for a while and then reconstituted itself with Charles Hayward, because we were playing on a record of Percy Howard, a group called Meridian, and we had some time left over in the studio when we were done, and we ended up improvising for a couple of actually for a precise amount of time. I think it's 74 minutes, because we actually, everything we did, we just put on a record exactly in the order we did it. So that was the new Massacre, as it were, and that group has been going ever since, and has a very different characteristic. So
it's interesting. Let me just mention, I was wondering about the Meridian connection, because I thought maybe Massacre was already going, and then somehow you hooked up with the singer, Percy Howard, or he liked you, and, you know, I was just kind of wondering how that happened, but the band actually happened because you were working with him then.
Absolutely. What happened was that Percy wanted Bill to produce him, and Bill was producing him and had Charlie Hayward lined up. I think there was a connection between Charles Hayward and Percy, and so he was going to be the drummer, and I think Bill suggested me as a possible guitar player. So I came over to do that record, and we had no thought about doing anything other than Percy's record. But we were stuck there at the end of the session, and I was waiting to go to the airport. I had a plane in the evening, and we were done by 11 o'clock in the morning, so I had the whole rest of the day. And Bill called Zorn about something else and told him what was going on, and Zorn said, make a record. I'll pay for it. So we just recorded, and we weren't even thinking it was Massacre. We just made a record, and Zorn was going to put it out, and then Zorn and Bill talked about it and came to me and said, this seems to us to be kind of like Massacre, so how do you feel about reconstituting that? And I thought, okay, why not? It actually took on a life of its own. We're still playing. Played a couple of gigs last year. And it's amazing how much life it has.
Yeah. Did you know Charles Hayward from England, or
he was a drummer who was around at the same time as Henry Cow. He was in a band called Quiet Sun with Phil Manzanera,
right?
And eventually started This Heat, which was towards the end of Henry Cow's life. They were just coming out, and we shared a rehearsal space called Cold Storage in London. So we met each other quite a lot then.
I was wondering if there was a connection there, because I didn't know if you'd played with him in those days, or you just, you know.
I knew about him, and then eventually we actually met, and then eventually we started playing together in different situations, and I invited him to be in my group Keep the Dog, which was the first time we'd done a sustained period of work together. Mm-hmm. So that was a kind of a retrospective group doing all kinds of material of mine. And he's now in my film band. I have a band called Eye to Ear, which is performing music from my film soundtracks, and he's the drummer of that as well.
I've always found him to be sort of a sneaky good drummer. It's like you would never really, no one ever says he's like their famous drummer, but you listen to him and he's just so good, you know, just in a very unobtrusive way, if you know what I mean, just solid and doesn't really call attention to what he's doing. And that's what I get from his
He has the same kind of absolutely solid time that someone like Jackie Liebertzeit has, and I think Liebertzeit had a definite impact on Charlie Haywood. But he's also very eccentric.
Oh.
So he's not at all the kind of like good drummer in the session sense. He goes off into some quite unusual places, and he and Bill together, what I really like is that they are completely elastic. They do things that I've never heard anybody else do. They kind of slow down and speed up the tempo together in an uncanny way, and they can suddenly change the material without warning. They're always inventing new ways of playing together. That it's the two of them together that I find extraordinary. Mm-hmm. I don't think Bill's ever played with a better drummer than Charles Haywood, and he's played with a lot of drums, and yes. So have I. So
yes, yeah. Okay, well. Can you maybe just back up a little bit and tell us what you were doing in England? You mentioned Henry Cow and Art Bears and stuff. Just basically what your musical, you know, situation was before coming to New York.
Well,
going way back,
I started out life as a performing musician, as a folk musician. I was playing in folk clubs in the north of England, which is where I grew up. And what were called working men's clubs, because they were working men's clubs. I think women were allowed once a week. And it was a very demanding audience, and I played songs and some blues. And then, influenced by hearing Indian music, I started to improvise in a slightly Indian way on the acoustic guitar and started exploring that. And in the meantime, I had been in bands since I was 14, playing R&B mostly. And ended up as a singer of a blues band, playing harmonica and not playing guitar at all for a while. And then when I went to college, I met Tim Hodgkinson in a blues club, actually. And we got along very well, and he invited me to something. He'd been asked to provide music for a dance performance based on Hiroshima. I took a violin, and he took his alto sax. And we didn't have any, we didn't really know about improvised music. We didn't know about improvisation. We hadn't heard any of what was going on in, you know, Derek Bailey and all that stuff. Didn't know anything about it. And we just improvised to the dance. And it was absolutely hair-raising, very deep thing that happened on that day. I mean, suddenly the possibilities of improvisation kind of we had exploding brains. And we decided to form a band, and we formed Henry Cow. And Henry Cow began, therefore, from a twin premise of absolutely free improvisation and some connection with R&B and blues. And that's where we started from, those twin polarities. And in the meantime, this being 1968, very rapidly we started hearing all kinds of stuff, like Grateful Dead Anthem for the Sun, for example, which had a profound effect on me. And it was very interesting to me to hear years later and to talk to Phil Lesh about it, that he'd been studying with Luciano Berio at Mills at the time before that, and had used many of the techniques he'd learned at Mills in the way that they'd actually put the recording together, including layering several different performances of the same material on top of each other. And I had no idea about that at the time, of course, but it kind of made an interesting connection years later.
Yeah.
And so there was that, and there was the fact that we were opening a lot for the other a big local band of the time, which was the Pink Floyd, who were in their pre... what was the name of their famous record? I don't even know what it was called.
Dark Side of the Moon?
Dark Side of the Moon, right. It was in the period before that, post Syd Barrett leaving. I was briefly in a band with Syd Barrett in Cambridge after he left the Pink Floyd. And we opened for the Pink Floyd on several occasions in rooms, with capacity of 150. So I got to see up close a kind of a rock improvisation, which was very interesting. And Dave Gilmour was always interesting to me, and he used to come and look at me play, and I used to be looking at him playing. And I guess I started life as an improviser from that basis, from the basis of doing something completely unexpected and spontaneous with Tim Hodgkinson, and kind of this rock thing, seeing Gong, seeing Pink Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
And Henry Cow ended up being my life for the next 10 years, as it turned out.
Well, I picture Henry Cow from what I've... I would just say the impression that I always had was that the compositions were very complicated and very convoluted, and they had a lot of different parts, and the playing was very precise. And, I mean, you're talking about sort of starting from blues and going into improvisation, and how did that fit in with the developing compositional sense?
Because we were listening to everything. We were interested in everything. In a period of about 2 years... We were exposed to so much that we'd never heard before. I mean, in my case, in 1 week, for example, it could be true that I heard Uncle Meat and, let's say, Big Pink, the band, and probably electronic music from Mimiroglu and others, and Berio's Visage, and read John Cage's Silence for the first time. And I mean, it was all coming in, mm-hmm. and hearing also Japanese court music, Gagaku, for the first time, because it was all coming out on record, because the record companies had absolutely no idea who was going to buy what, so they just put out everything in the hope that, you know, to see what would happen. Later, they calibrated the market to the point that they never had to do that anymore. But there was a brief period of about 5 or 6 years when the record companies made everything available, and so we were soaking it all up.
Yeah.
And Henry Cow did everything. We did do complicated compositions because we thought, why not? I mean, we hadn't had music training, but we did, you know, we were hardworking, and we were naive, and therefore we thought we could do it. And so I wrote compositions which were very much influenced by Messiaen, and Tim wrote compositions that were influenced by Stockhausen or... others, I can't even remember anymore. But yes, we were writing complicated parts. What set us apart from other groups of the time was that we actually had music stands on stage some of the time, and were trying to read stuff that we could scarcely play. We taught ourselves how to play our instruments by writing things that we didn't know how to do.
Mm-hmm.
And
then learning how.
And we were improvising, and we were playing songs, and we were using found sound. So in our later years, we were using tape recorders with tapes that we'd prepared, and the others didn't know what we had on our tapes, and we had them on volume pedals so that we could just introduce them. It was kind of like a pre-sampling heaven. You know, there weren't many things that we didn't try out. So if you remember us as the complex composition, that's a very small part of what we were doing, but an important part.
Live, probably, the improvisation took over, whereas in the studio, not so much, or...
From gig to gig, it would vary. I mean, the DVD that we just released as part of this 10-volume set, most of what we're doing is compositions. It was for TV, and I'm sure the TV didn't want us to do any improvising, so we did, you know, we all look a little unhappy, I know that. it's quite interesting to see this. I mean, I hadn't seen Henry Cow before on stage, and it's very intense and very... very meticulous. I'm very impressed at how tight it is. But I mean, there was a whole other side to our lives that isn't there at all, and I'm sure it's because the TV didn't allow us to do it.
I remember reading that you said at one point that you really learned how to use a recording studio, or you learned how valuable it is to use a recording studio with Henry Cow. When you brought the band in there, you actually learned that the recording studio is, you know, a great tool rather than just something to capture a live band.
Absolutely. We were incredibly lucky, talking of being in the right place at the right time. I mean, we happened to have, after 5 years, I mean, we'd been together for 5 years when we made our first record, so we were very tight at that point. We had very clear, and we were also... things were starting to take off, and people were starting to notice us, and it all kind of coincided. John Peel got very interested in us. We played his show a few times, and there was this new young label called Virgin who had absolutely no clue what they were doing and thought that they could make big stars out of people like us. And it turned out that Mike Oldfield saved their butt for quite a few years by selling 6 million copies of Tubular Bells, which nobody could have predicted. Mm-hmm. And they basically kept us all going on the strength of that. And so until they kind of had a big corporate shift, and the people who started the label were all kind of leaving, and they started trying to get people like the Rolling Stones and so on, before that, it was this kind of weird idealistic moment when they poured resources into us. I mean, it was lunatic, because there was no way we were ever going to be what they thought we were going to be. It would have been totally impossible. But there's Richard Branson coming to the recording studio and watching us record and hanging out, and he's got this mansion with this multi-track recorder in it, and we live there for a month.
The right place at the right time, huh?
You know, and we work whenever we want. We're working night and day, at the hours that we choose, and the engineer very often doesn't show up, so we do it ourselves. Or, you know, he's drunk and lying under the console snoring while we're working, as happened on one occasion. but in his favor, he was totally in favor of our doing it ourselves. So he showed us how everything worked, and he encouraged us to take care of it, and he told us what was wrong, and told us about meters and equalization and everything. So we had a great teacher and unlimited time, and, you know, we would spend a month in there recording and then go back and mix. You know, it was, now I do the recording and mixing in a week. But in those days, and exactly when we needed it, because we hadn't got a clue what we were doing. And so the first record, we put everything that we already had onto the record. But the second record, when we had a month and no material, or very little material, we were able to explore, and we explored what happens when you improvise for 2 hours and then take out the bits that seem like they might lead to something and turn them into songs. What happens when you make a 16-track tape loop that's about 30 feet long and have people standing in corners of the studio with pencils? All this had been done by people before, but we didn't really know about it. So we were in this blissful state of naivety and exploring. And yes, we learned about how you compose, basically. We learned about form and structure and all the stuff you learn about when you're composing, except that we learned it in a completely different kind of way. And it's interesting to me, as a composer of acoustic music, that I think I'm as much influenced by what I've done in the studio as I am by anything else. So I'm writing, composing as if I'm doing crossfades and edits and treatments and so on. You know,
yeah.
It's just a mindset.
Talk a little bit about the Henry Cow box. You mentioned it real briefly, but what was Henry Cow's material output, and then what is this box in relation to what had been out previously?
We had mostly done studio records which focused more on composed music than anything else. Unrest is slightly different, in as much as a lot of the material was based on improvisation, the thing we've just been talking about. But Legend, Unrest, In Praise of Learning, and Western Culture, four studio records, are pretty much all composed music. We'd done one record of concerts, so there was one example of live music of all the stuff, and some of it was, it contained composed music as well in the concert. So there was a whole side of our work which was not represented. And the two critical sides that were not represented were the very long, big-scale improvisation that we'd done, and the other was the fact that we were constantly rewriting the things we'd already written. So we would do versions of pieces that would be almost unrecognizable. We would cut things up and put them in different places and insert material into two polarities of one composition. And in other words, every concert became a new composition using the elements of all the other compositions. So this had never really made itself felt. And there was a lot of material out there, and a lot of it was coming out on extremely bad bootlegs. So we finally decided that we should, you know, see what was out there. And Chris took this on, and he discovered radio recordings, especially things that we'd done for radio stations in Germany and Sweden, and the TV thing from Switzerland. So there was very high-quality, well-made recordings of us being our extreme selves, which you don't really hear in the same way on the studio recordings. And it took him a long time to persuade us to do it on the scale that it is. I mean, I thought we might get a couple of records out of it. But he was dogged.
So it's a 10-CD set and a DVD?
It's 9 CDs and a DVD. And when I finally heard the material that he, when Bob Drake had done all the remastering and cleaned everything up, and when we finally heard all of that stuff, I must say I was absolutely blown away. I mean, I just couldn't. I had forgotten so much of that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's a long time ago. I mean, we broke up in 1978. It's 30 years ago. And I hadn't paid it much mind. I'd been busy getting on with other things. And it was the first time when I've gone back and listened to that, and it was really a revelation, some of it. I mean, really There were so many ways in which we seem to be ahead of our time, especially hearing all the stuff we were doing with tape recordings and stuff.
Was there any sense of, we did that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't remember that. Did you?
Well, I'm looking at the DVD and hearing myself playing piano and also hearing myself playing guitar parts that I certainly don't remember and which I certainly didn't think I could do. Hmm. I mean, really complicated things. I mean, I guess I could play once. I mean,
well, I bet
you still. Reassuring.
Yeah. So who put this out?
Well, Chris did it on his label. So
is it recommended?
We're in control of it. RER. So, we've got three boxes. So the two boxes are five, and then another box which you can put these studio recordings into, so you could have them all in the same format.
Do you mind if I ask what the interest has been in that? Have people been buying them, or I mean, just what kind of exposure? Because that's a pretty extremely large package for just, you know, the casual listener.
Well, we split it into two so that you can buy half of it, which makes it a little bit more modest. What I've been noticing is I've been getting emails from people saying, "Well, I'm up to number three." You know, people are really, and there was a review in All About Jazz, which was about 8 pages long, of somebody who'd actually really listened to everything and talked about the whole thing. So there's interest, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, how many units we're actually selling, who knows? But, I mean, CDs don't sell anywhere anymore. So
yeah.
For us, it's more the fact that it's there, and therefore it's a resource that people can use and understand better who we were. This is not going to be a for-profit venture, that's for sure. I mean, just the time that Chris has spent alone would be far more than anything we can expect to make for
right, right. Speaking of labels, I meant to ask you about Fred Records. You've got your own label that is putting out, I guess, archival material that's out of print otherwise or something.
Most of it actually hasn't. Well, it's 50-50 between stuff that's out of print and stuff that hasn't ever been released.
Oh.
So one of the things, for example, that I've been doing on Fred Records is releasing music that I've written for choreographers. I do a lot of composing for choreographers. It very rarely gets released, and I'm sitting on masses of it. I've got another release coming shortly. And it's composed music that I'm actually very interested in, and which occupies a space which is quite different from when I compose for an ensemble, for example, or when I'm in a band. It's a strange hybrid form. So I'm glad to have that out and available. Plus some interesting projects like the thing I did in a French, when I was composer in residence in a music school in France for a couple of years, and the final project involved occupying every room in the building with musicians, a lot of pianos, an African drum ensemble, some jazz combos, an orchestra, I mean, you know, a whole bunch of different musicians. And the audience was walking around outside in the courtyard listening through the windows. And the musicians were all synchronized with stopwatches, so precise things would happen at precise times.
Oh, wow.
But you would be able to circulate and hear more of one thing and another thing. You could even walk through the corridors if you wanted to. So it was a kind of an ambulatory experience in listening to of composed music. And I just released that, for example, which is on the Impure, on Fred Records. And that's in two parts. There's an Impure Part 2, which is about to come out. So it gives me a chance to get stuff out there that I wouldn't be able to get out there otherwise. I prefer, I mean, the labels that I work with, like Tzadik or Winter and Winter or Intact, tend to be focused on the things that I'm doing right now, so they have less interest, because usually record labels kind of figure that if they're going to put out a record, they want to know that the musicians on that record are actually going to go out and do stuff, which helps them to sell it.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So,
all right, well, we kind of got off on a tangent there, which is fine, because this is all very interesting stuff. But I wanted to then talk about, you talked about how you ended up going to New York via Giorgio Gomelsky and some of the people that you hooked up with there. So you were pretty busy, I guess you could say, and your name showed up in a lot of places, a lot of collaborations on a lot of people's albums for, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 years there, something like that, in New York. So what sorts of things were you doing there besides the Skeleton Crew and the Laswell stuff? What other kinds of things were you involved in?
Well, when I first got there, I was in a very prolific period. I think between 79 and 83, for example, all three Art Bears records, Gravity Speechless, Cheap at Half the Price, The stuff with the residents, stuff with material, massacre, all kinds of appearances on other people's records, Kip Hanrahan, all kinds of folks. And it seemed, I go in cycles. That was certainly an extraordinarily fertile period, that period. And of course, you know, meeting Zorn and Leslie and Bob Ostertag, another one who I've worked with, and Ikwe. I mean, these are people who I'm still very much closely involved with. So it was a very, very fertile period. And it's interesting because I feel like I'm in another one right now. So I've been talking about it lately, how I really feel at the moment as if I'm at the beginning of something. And it was very parallel to what I felt in 79, when I felt like I was ready to start a whole bunch of new things, and that's exactly what I'm doing at the moment. So I'm happy I can still do that.
Yeah. So you moved from New York to the Bay Area, or was there something in between there? Because obviously now you're located here and have been for, what, at least a decade, I would think, something like that. What?
I've been here for 10 years, but before that, I moved back to Europe in, 1990, when I met my current partner, and we moved to Germany, because she's from Germany. And so, and we started a family, so I was kind of involved in that.
Extra musical things, yeah.
We actually ended up living in Big Sur briefly in 94. I had a commission to write, had commissions to write the Rover piece and also to write Pacifica for an Italian group. And Henry Cow's ex-roadie, Sula, lives in Big Sur, and she had just built a cabin that she said we could use. So we moved to Big Sur for a year and a half, and our daughter was born there, and I did a lot of composing. And then we moved back afterwards to Germany when the money ran out. And then Mills came knocking on the door, so that's when I came to Oakland.
Okay, so you started at Mills not as an instructor, which you are now, you're a professor there, but you just as a like a guest composer, or what? How did you first get started with Mills?
I had actually played at Mills during the period when Braxton was here. I think Henry Kaiser hooked me up, and I did a solo concert at Mills. Like, it must have been in the 80s. And then in 97... Chris Brown invited me to come and do a residency. So I stayed for 2 or 3 weeks working with students. I remember Ben Goldberg was a student at that time, and Graham Connor, people who've become local luminaries. Mm-hmm. They were all students then. And then a couple of years later, this job came up, and they invited me to apply for it. So I did, and I didn't really either wanted or expect to get it, to be honest. I just wondered if I was actually employable, so I did it on a whim, because I never had a real job. So I thought, you know, maybe I might have to be in the job market one day. Let's see what happens. And I applied and got the job, and then we panicked and didn't really know what to do. So, and then ended up doing it and thinking we were going to do it for 3 years, and have been here ever since.
Okay, so you're a professor of composition, and specifically, I guess, performance and improvisation. Can you explain a little bit about what your role there is on the faculty at Mills?
I was hired to take care of particularly acoustic music improvisation, I would say. I mean, the thing about Mills is that everybody does everything. I mean, the faculty is really extraordinary. And, you know, there are already lots of, when I arrived, lots of really interesting improvisers. I mean, Alvin Curran and Chris Brown, Maggie Payne, these are people who've been, you know, improvising and composing for a long time. We all improvise and compose. We all of us, to some degree, use electronics. But we're all hired in different special areas. But like the students, we tend to cross over constantly into different areas. So it's a very flexible program. And I was hired to work with improvisers, but I also teach composition, and have done from the very beginning. And we've discovered it along the way that there was a category of composer who didn't quite really fit into the traditional composer category, the people who were more coming from improvisation, and it led us eventually to decide to have an improvisation degree. So now you can get an MFA in improvisation from Mills, which makes it kind of unique. There aren't many places where you can do that.
Yeah.
And it's led to an influx of amazing musicians coming in who in that area, so it's also made the program grow in a different way.
You recently did a concert at Mills, there was a whole. We've talked about this on our station before, but the reopening of the concert hall at Mills, and there was a series of concerts. I think about a half dozen of them earlier this year, which culminated in this concert that you did in April.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about the concert that you did, particularly. A lot of the people that were involved in the concert were people that you've already talked about, people you've worked with a number of times over the years, but just a little bit about what kinds of things happened at that concert and how you thought it went.
Well, I had fun. I mean, what can I say?
And I had fun listening to it from the audience, but just...
It's a bit weird to do a concert which is called a 60th birthday concert, even though it's not your 60th birthday, but, you know, it was my 60th birthday year, so I kind of felt we could get away with it. And I wanted to present the whole spectrum of my work as far as I could. So I wanted to make sure that we had at least some kind of composed music, and also some work with improvisers, and also my band, new band, and some more intimate improvisation, like the duo I did with Roscoe, for example. So I tried to represent, which is something I don't usually like to do because I think it's a bit artificial. So I was a bit worried about whether it would just seem like a little bit of this and a little bit of that without ever really going anywhere. In order to offset that, I tried, as I usually do, to avoid the kind of formality that concerts tend to have, where you have the thing and then it stops and people applaud and everybody walks off and they reset the stage and they bring everything on again and you do the next thing. And so I tried to make it flow as much as I could and to make the whole thing into one big composition. That's mm-hmm. my idea, which is something very much coming from working on records, as we were talking about earlier. It's like when you're making a record, it's not the song that you're composing, it's also the order of the songs and how they fit together and what you need to do to them to make it sound like a whole. And so for me, a concert is the same idea. I want to make the concert into a whole. And I think that kind of worked in the end. I mean, you were there. You can tell me.
Yeah, well, there were people on the stage, and just as one thing was sort of finishing, someone else would come walking and then just kind of pick it up from there, and then it would go in a different direction, and then those people would not be involved anymore.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I did think that was kind of interesting. Yeah,
it's just I don't like formal concerts very much. I find it... sometimes it really aids your listening to frame something in that way, and sometimes it just becomes really tedious. So it was that was my approach, and it was the culmination of the whole series of concerts for the reopening of the concert hall, which is a colossal undertaking, which was, the whole thing was a huge success. We sold out 6 concerts and attracted people to the Mills campus who've never go there, and so we're pretty excited about what can happen next, of mm-hmm. course. And this was the last of the series, so it was definitely a party atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Not just because of my birthday.
Well, they did have champagne afterward.
Real champagne, too.
Yeah. Champagne and, like, cupcakes or something. I thought it was interesting, during your concert, you played some of your graphic scores for a large ensemble and smaller chamber group music and, as you said, various collaborations and duos and things. I really enjoyed the male-female balance. I think it was more female players than males. I just thought that was really interesting. It gave a really... Why do I think it's interesting? I don't know. There's just something about creative female energy that I just think is really, really appeals to me, and some really strong players and people who I think are very creative, like Ikue and Zina. And I really thought that was great, rather than just a bunch of guys up there on stage,
Well, I haven't done the bunch of guys thing much, because I guess I was lucky enough from a very early age to be in a position where a lot of my mentors were women. My first violin teacher was an extraordinary woman who really changed my life in ways that I'm still only beginning to appreciate from the age of 5. And Henry Cow, in our most important moment for 3 or 4 years, we were 3 men and 3 women, and we had women sound engineers and a woman bus driver, and so we were used to being in a very, shall we call it, gender balance situation, and also to being re-instructed. And we had a lot of heavy discussions. I mean, this is the heyday of the new feminism mm-hmm. in the 70s, and of course we were totally typical men, and we had a lot of shit to deal with, as you can imagine. So it was tough, but it was also very life-changing. And I think it's inevitable since then that I've worked probably continuously with women as much as men since Henry Cowell. I don't think it could have been any other way. I don't think about it too much, to tell you the truth. I'm not that interested in the fact that I have to do it. I'm actually doing it because my favorite musicians seem to turn out to be women a lot of the time, and you know, the chance to play with Carla and Zena in a band is extraordinary.
Yeah,
they're amazing musicians from whom I learn a lot, so that's the way it should be. I mean, I'm sure they're learning from me too, so it's just fine.
Can we talk a little bit about Cosa Brava? It's your band, since you mentioned Carla and Zena, and Cosa Brava did do a performance there at that concert. So this is something that's ongoing. In fact, it's fairly recent. It's only been around like a year or so, something like that, maybe?
We started, I had a sabbatical year, and I used the sabbatical year to launch a whole bunch of different things, and Cosa Brava was the focal point of that. Zena came and taught at Mills while I was on sabbatical, and we rehearsed with Carla and Matthias Bossi, who's the drummer, and the Norman Conquest, who's our sound engineer and designer. And we ended up doing a tour of 17 concerts in 17 days in 8 countries.
Oh.
last April, a year ago. And since then, we've played a few concerts here and there as time has permitted, because all of our schedules tend to be very busy. And we recorded, December we recorded an album, which we are waiting to finish. We need some overdubs and some mixing, but basically that's the extent of us so far, and I hope we'll be touring after Carla's baby is delivered, which is due in August.
So how would you describe Cosa Brava's music?
Those are the kind of questions you never know what to say.
I can scratch that question if you...
You know, it's a band. We do songs. It has a lot of the things that people have come to identify with me to do with a certain kind of folk influence here and there in the music. We also have a certain improvisational aspect to the music, but it's not so much about that. It's really about songs. And periodically, I like to have groups that do songs. I mean, you know, Henry Cow, we had our song side, but Art Bears was all about songs. And since the material of Art Bears has been reissued not that long ago and has attracted a lot more attention, I think that's some of my strongest work. I think Winter Songs, I think, is one of my strongest compositional pieces, so all of those songs considered as a whole. And Skeleton Crew, the collaboration with Tom, was very important to me as a song group, and I haven't really done that since, and I really missed it. So this was an opportunity to go back to that place and see what I had to say in it now, after a gap of 15 years. So that's what I'm doing.
Okay, so that there's guitar and vocals and violin, and Zena is doing keyboards and accordion.
Yeah, and I play bass as well as guitar. So
I need to ask about Norman.
The Norman,
yeah. You and I have talked before, and you kind of explained what he does, and I understand that he is a member of the group. However, he works out in the house creating a sort of sound design for the band while they're playing. But I guess I don't really understand so much. How can I say this? What sounds different than if he wasn't there? For instance, if I'm hearing you playing guitar or bass or the drums, and I'm hearing some kind of like an interesting sound or EQ or something, I don't know if that's coming from the stage or from him. How would I, as a listener, you know, evaluate his contribution to the band if all I'm really seeing is four people playing? What is he doing?
Well, what I hope he's doing, and what everybody tells me he's doing, is making us sound great. He also has, you know, parts that he's devised for himself, so there are different treatments that he's applying to different instruments at different times in a very precise way, which he's rehearsed with us. So, you know, there's a whole not notated but preconceived element that he's worked on. I mean, he's basically got a design in which we live. But as a traditional sound engineer as well as the experimental sound engineer, he combines both roles. So Anybody who's been in a rock band knows how important the sound engineer is and how disastrous it is if you don't have one. You can go on the road without a sound engineer. It means you're going to be using a different sound engineer every night, and they have no idea what you're doing.
Right.
So, and then you think you're going to sound good? Well, not really.
Yeah.
So for me, the role of the sound, and this is since Henry Cow, I mean, you know, we had our own sound engineer, and it was an integral part of the group, and we couldn't possibly have functioned without that. And they were paid the same as we were. I mean, this was you know, regarded as the same kind of a job. And that's my philosophy now as well. I think everybody should have their own sound engineer. And I would not think about going on the road with Cosa Brava without one.
Mm-hmm.
And Norman is a member of the band, so.
Well, I wasn't trying to be difficult and question what he does. It's just, I guess it's not real obvious to a listener what he's doing. I mean, I see what the drummer's doing. I see what the violinist is doing. I don't know what he's doing and what it would sound like if he wasn't doing it. So I guess I just kind of have to accept that the band sounds good. Okay, he's playing a part in that, you know?
You better believe he's playing a part in that. And a much more wide-ranging part than a lot of people understand. I mean, you know, there may be very minute changes in the sound of a particular drum from song to song. There might be a completely different equalization or a different reverb on the accordion in this song than on that one, which is, you know, just like in a recording studio, every song has its own sound world.
Mm-hmm.
You're creating the world in which the song lives. He's doing that, except we're doing it live.
Do you ever have any reason to need to communicate with him while you're playing? I mean, obviously you can walk over to the drummer and whisper something while you're playing. You know, what if you're saying, hey, something's not working here? Or if you, I mean, do you just stop playing and yell out into the house? I mean, you know, how do you communicate, or do you not really have any need to?
We don't need to do that.
You don't need
everything works all the time.
That was a dumb question, wasn't it? All right, well, would you say we hear some more music? This has been fascinating. Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, this is really good. I really wanted to do a lot of talking with you, but yeah, I imagine you're probably talked out for the moment anyway till I make you do some more. Can we hear some Skeleton Crew? You had mentioned that earlier as one of the things you were doing with Tom Cora, and you did songs, and Zena was in Skeleton Crew at one point too.
The second album. We started off, it's a complicated story, but we hadn't intended to be two one-man bands. We actually had a quartet with Fred Meyer. The story was that while I was away one summer, Material got involved in producing Herbie Hancock, and it was a huge success. But then it was disagreed about who had actually done the producing, as a result of which Bill Laswell ended up being nominated as the producer, and the others split off from him. And so he and Fred were not speaking.
Oh.
And so I had a new version of Massacre that we were working on, Bill and I, with Ronald Chan and Jackson, which didn't work out.
I did not know that.
And I decided to work with Fred in another context. So Fred and Tom and Tim Schellenbaum and I formed a band called Mayday, which you can even see is supposed to have played at festivals in Europe, although I never actually did. But you can see us on their archival materials. Because the two of them both got collapsed lungs in the same week and ended up in hospital. And then they got out, and we were starting to rehearse, and then one of them got a recurrence of the collapsed lung and went back, and so on and so on. And at a certain point, it looked like this just wasn't going to work out, and I had gigs set up, and I said, you know, well, maybe we should do what I've always wanted to do, which is just play everything ourselves. And he said, great. So we went for it. The first tour, we were joined by Dave Newhouse, who was in the Muffins at the time, and he helped us out, although it was not a permanent arrangement, and after one tour he left, and there was just the two of us, and that's when we started really working on the material that you can hear, and we were actually very much working from the traditional one-man band perspective. So we each played components of a drum kit, as well as our instruments, in his case bass and cello, in my case keyboards and guitar. We both sang, and we basically did everything at once. And after the first stage of the group, we decided to have a third member, and Zena was showing up, so she became the third member of Skeleton Crew, and we wrote a whole new set of material with three of us doing the same basic approach with her playing drums and keyboards.
Did you have plans to do further things with Tom before he passed away, or was you had already just sort of maybe played with him and then kind of moved on, or were there things in the works? Or
well, we stopped Skeleton Crew because it started, from my point of view, one thing I learned from Henry Cow was that not to keep doing something when you've done everything you have to do. And I felt like at a certain point, Skeleton Crew started to sound like a normal band. And that made no sense to me. We might just as well have gotten a drummer in and done something completely different. We got too good at it. I liked it when we were always breaking down. When we stopped breaking down, I got less interested. And then, so we stopped Skeleton Crew, and then Tom got involved with the X, and I was doing other stuff. Zena and I got involved in Keep the Dog. And Tom and I still occasionally played together as a duo. You know, we were in touch. And then towards the end, we started to play together a lot more. So actually, we played in a trio with Chris Cutler about 2 weeks before he died, actually. So we were still actively playing together right up to the end.
Okay. I forgot what track you said you wanted me to play from Skeleton Crew.
Not My Shoes.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I've got it queued up right here. Sorry about that. There we go. Pick up the right one here. Okay. It's Skeleton Crew. Oh, my goodness. It's KFJC 89.7 FM and the Fred Fritz Special. We'll be here until 4 p.m.
nothing see, nothing say, nothing be, nothing. Hear nothing see, nothing say, nothing be, nothing. Hear nothing see, nothing say, nothing be, nothing.
Listening to KFJC 89.7 FM. Max Level, your host for another hour here with Fred Frith in the studio. 4 hours of Fred Frith music and conversation. Today, we just heard from Skeleton Crew. And Fred, why don't you tell us... Well, I guess you basically did. You basically told us about Skeleton. Tell me about those particular tracks. How about that?
Interestingly enough, the last one, the lyrics are by Rebbe Sharp, who was in a band at the time called the Orthotonics. And I always really liked her lyrics, and I just asked her to collaborate with me on some of the Cosa Brava lyrics, so that connection is still there, which is very nice. So the first of the two tracks was with Just Me and Tom, and then obviously the second one was with Zena Added, so it gives you a little idea of the trajectory that we went through. And the second record, curiously enough, was produced by Tim Hodgkinson from Henry Cow. So there are all kinds of interconnections
going on all the time. These people keep popping up, don't they? Yeah. And Chris Cutler also, you have a long-running musical collaboration with him in different sorts of formats as well, going back to Henry Cow.
And we've been doing the Art Bears songbook. We played at the Victoriaville Festival last year with great success. We have a six-piece version of the doing all the Art Bears songs, so that's ongoing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, tell me a little bit about this.
Well, I brought a few things.
Paolo Angeli, the guitar player.
Paolo Angeli. He's a music historian and guitar player from Sardinia. He's written a fabulous book about the folk music of Sardinia, and he's the guitar of Sardinia is a rather larger guitar instrument with a lower tuning, and he's reinvented this instrument. He did a workshop with me in Bologna, which led to my writing the piece Pacifica for a group that he was a part of, and one of the ensemble had 22 people in it and involved three guitar players, and I basically wrote parts which involved them having to not play the guitar regularly but lie them flat and play them with open tunings and so on. And he kind of got interested and went away and worked a new version of the guitar, and many years later he's come up with this completely different instrument, really, which has got a pneumatic foot-controlled set of stops which can play the strings at the same time as he's playing with the hands, so he can actually play much more complicated rhythmic arrangements. And he made a cover version, a record of cover versions of pieces by me and also by Björk, which is an interesting combination. And one of the pieces is a record from a record I did called Speechless, and what he's covering, he covers quite a few different things on the record, but he's covering a piece called A Head in the Sand. And I could not believe that one person was playing all of these parts live. Mm. What you're hearing is a live recording of Paolo playing solo.
Is it like a third hand or something? You're talking about these pneumatic stops on the strings?
Little stops that are coming down, which he's got foot pedals, which he's playing with his feet while he's playing with his hands. He's also one of the most charming people you could possibly hope to meet.
Mm. Okay, well, let's hear this then. Paolo Angeli. Doing A Head in the Sand. We do have one more Fred Frith CD to give away. It is his solo acoustic guitar CD titled To Sail, To Sail. Came out last year on Zadok Records. And the third caller at 650-941-2500 can pick up a copy of this CD. Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC 89.7 FM, Los Altos Hills.